The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Healthy relationships. In my opinion, society does not place enough value on platonic love, says Jordana Jacobs, PhD, a psychologist in New York City. The strictly non-sexual relationship has the potential to be deep, intense, and life-altering, she says. But how to make them work, especially if you're married to someone else, is a question that many couples and friends grapple with. Platonic relationship basically means a super deep connection. This type of friendship can exist between many pairs, though it's most commonly associated with a connection between members of the opposite sex. Think When Harry Met Sally. Of course, it can also occur between pals of all genders and orientation. It's worth noting that not every friendship is a platonic one. When you meet a person, there is a process by which you determine what kind of role they'll play in your life, including how close you are meant to be with them, says Jacobs. If you ultimately end up feeling that deep connection, that's platonic love. A healthy platonic friendship means no sexual feelings are involved. I see platonic love as a special emotional and spiritual relationship between two people, says Diana Robb, PhD, author of Writing for Bliss. It does not involve any type of sexual interest, but there is deep caring, mutual respect, and loyalty, she says. Jacob says that platonic love is actually a helpful building block for romantic love. It creates a foundation that ultimately allows us to be brave enough to take necessary risks in romantic love, because it's often more reliable and stable, she argues. Signs you're in a platonic relationship include feeling that famous friend crush. The friend crush is very real, says Jacobs. This isn't the butterflies in the stomach kind of nervous crush you get around someone you want to kiss, but more of a compatibility crush. That process needs not be sexual in nature, but rather is more about the power of human connection in general and its ability to make us feel more alive, Jacobs explains. It occurs when we've met someone and become infatuated, when we feel seen, understood, and less alone in this world. That's how you know you've got real platonic love, when you're understood. The number one rule of a platonic relationship is to maintain boundaries. This can't be overemphasized, says Rob. If, for example, you're traveling with this friend that you could ultimately feel a sexual connection toward, that neither of you are interested in exploring, stay in a separate hotel room. Also, avoid conversations that could veer towards flirtatiousness. Read, even after a drink or two, unless it's a road you're considering exploring, don't share those fantasies. Platonic relationships can exist outside of marriage, but be cautious. It's normal for your spouse to be jealous of a platonic relationship, says Rob, but communication is crucial to help manage those feelings. Jealousy is always connected to some kind of fear, she says. Being out in the open, saying, I'm going to dinner tonight with so-and-so, instead of I'm going to dinner, helps to solve that fear by showing your partner they're not losing footing with you. And when people start hiding things, that is what leads to suspicion and jealousy, she explains. If your spouse is still struggling, ask yourself, are your spouse's concerns actually founded, and are you willing to give up your marriage for this friend? If not, you may want to scale back the time you spend with the other person. Yes, you can be platonically in love with someone. There seems to be an idea in our culture that platonic love is somehow a threat to romantic love, that you can't feel both at the same time, in other words. This isn't true, says Jacobs. Rob agrees, with her own experience as evidence. There is so much strength in a strong friendship, she says. Intimacy does not always enhance that. So can platonic relationships work? The short answer is yes, if you're willing to put in the time. But to make sure no one develops feelings for anyone else, it's worth checking in with your friend to see if everyone's on the same page. Have an open and clear discussion around what each person wants in the relationship, says Jacobs. Even if there is fear around having this conversation, avoiding the topic could do more harm than good. It's possible that the consequences of unexplored, misaligned intentions could result in resentment and potentially lead to the very end of the friendship. Our next article by Amani Perry is titled, Don't Teach Your Kids Bedside Manners. The last time I was in the hospital, someone forgot to give me toiletries for the first 2 days and nights I slept there. Someone has that task. Someone is more likely to remember if they see that the patient is someone's worry. If a person comes with a patient and in nervous declaration asks questions, is solicitous, maybe even aggressive. I was alone and slept over 18 hours each day. The paper underwear grew sour with sweat. I felt a pauper's grief each time my eyes opened, so I closed them again. Later I would say I didn't ask someone for toiletries because, you know, I was so disoriented. But I would think they would just do that as a matter of course. Matter of fact, in retrospect, it was more likely depression, not disorientation, the swirling sort. I tried to remind myself of what could be worse. Well, a catheter, certainly. The worst part of the catheter is that the discomfort is greater than the humiliation. How low are you when you stop caring about someone tending to your siphoned waste because your energy resides in the worrying pressure on your ureter, a part of your body you are accustomed to not knowing at all, no matter how much you use it? Yes, that would be worse. You beat back the day's sorrow with cleanliness. I remembered that wisdom the third day. Section and braid your hair into plates, brush your teeth thoroughly, wash, wash, and wash, spread the watery lotion over you, tie on the gown with care as though it is clothing, stuff the old gown, the old pants, the old sheets in the corner, even hunched over and hurt, smooth the new ones on the bed. Stand up for a while. You feel better if only for exactly how long it takes to realize that no one sees or cares about your ritual, least of all you. I wasn't in this time for complications from systemic lupus or Graves' disease. The last time, this is what happened. I had 3 kidney stones. They lodged inside somewhere and caused an infection. This was good. The pain brought me into the emergency room. And in the process of examining me, doctors and nurses noted that I was experiencing a thyroid storm. I also had sepsis from the infection. It entered my blood. In my own words, when I tell people, friends, these things, they move past them quickly. It's not that their discomfort bothers me. It's that I don't know if they turn their heads to the right from discomfort only or also from disregard. Not of me, necessarily, but of truth. Outside, I'm different. Highly competent. I manage work and life. I'm building a legacy, I think, in the most hubris-filled moments. There is always the nagging worry of being like Ivan Ilyich, however. Ilyich, from Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich, is the kind of bourgeois person who, in addition to having misguided priorities, I don't think I have those, lives in the delusion of an endless life, or ever-blooming competence despite daily frustrations, until he learns he is going to die. We are all going to die. But for Ilyich, death is coming soon, and he has to live like this on the edge of destruction alone, Tolstoy writes, with nobody at all to understand or pity him. Ilyich grows impatient with the people in his life who do not want to talk about his impending fate. The emotional scampering away is common in sickness and in death, and the vacancy of my hospital room is a reminder, a fun house of refracted and repeated loneliness. There are, of course, people who, after the crisis has been averted, say to me, why didn't you ask for help? The implication of the irritated question is that asking to the point of begging has not been a feature of my life for years. But I have learned people usually don't want you to ask. People want you to be satisfied with what they have to give and to never say another word. Generosity should honestly be split into 2 words, one for the giving to another, and one for the giving that is a self-congratulation fitting neatly into how the giver sees himself, regardless of the other. The latter is an abundance. The former, oh, it is rare. It rents the veil too much. After he passes, the lesson of the death of Ivan Ilyich is even more potent. His colleagues feel grateful that it was not them. They are eager to do the memorial in a quick and perfunctory way. Yes, I think, we are so afraid of death. So much so that even disease and disability are treated in this way. People delight in not being afflicted like you. It is an ugly human trait, and I am afraid most of us have it. The moment I am free and clear of the hospital, it slips into me, that ugliness, for all the lonely people still on the wards. Ashamed, I know this is a terror that bars necessary intimacy. Courage is in short supply when it comes to these matters, except in the moments of great love. Perhaps that is the purpose of love. It isn't just the warm feeling, the joy. It is the prospect of a human integrity beyond what seems possible. My son was brought by his father on the fifth day. He asked if he could get in the bed with me. I scooted over to make room. He said, "I just didn't know. I've never been in the hospital before." Oh, how I loved that. The honesty alongside the desire for closeness. I am so glad my teeth are clean. I am so glad the mustiness is off my body and I am well rested enough to smile honestly at him. We are noisy when the woman who works in food service arrives. She smiles at him. "Handsome boy," she says. He is lithe and vivid. When she leaves, we turn our noses up at the food. I eat the crackers and drink the juice. I do not sleep as long that night, but my rest is not fretful. In the death of Ivan Ilyich, it is his servant, Gerasim, who sues Ilyich when his spoiled family fails. Gerasim, the peasant, knows the true meaning of life and the inevitability of death. He is tender and attentive. It is one of those vexing portraits. It is true, the bourgeois often worry about the wrong things. Poor folks are often closer to understanding virtue and decency. But it's also a romantic projection, and here, as in place after place, this portrayal deprives the peasant of the interiority of his own struggles and suffering. He exists mainly as a lesson. Literature, even great literature, is full of this. But there are in fact people in this world who maintain the gift of clarity when it comes to kindness. Children have it, usually, but we socialize them out of it. At some point, they learn that a tearful reaction to bleeding is not okay. Lying down when one's stomach or heart hurts is vanity. Working in ways that strip your soul is applauded. In children, we replicate ourselves in the worst ways. Thank goodness they hold on for as long as they can. I have always been afraid of colonizing my children's lives, of relying on them too much. You have children to let them go eventually, hoping they will stay connected to you, but you are not entitled to that. Emotional responsibility should not be a bullying thing. It should be a loving, intimate thing. It should be a sewn together thing. But I would be lying if I denied that it's the sunlight of a child breaking through the loneliness that saves me every time. It will not decimate it. It will just ease it when nothing else does. This is living. This essay is adapted from Ward by Imani Perry, excerpt from The Lonely Stories, an anthology edited by Natalie Eve Garrett. Imani Perry, author of South to America, is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, where she also teaches in gender and sexuality studies, law and public affairs, and jazz studies. A native of Birmingham, Alabama, she lives outside of Philadelphia with her sons. Our next article by Hay Shaninian is titled "The Difference Between Meaning Well and Doing Well." When my husband and I adopted our newborn biracial daughter, I proudly snapped photos of her and pasted them to handwritten announcements I sent everyone we knew. I instantly loved this child. I vowed to carve out a world for her that was free of bigotry, including bigotry against gay men like her two dads. Her picture book showed people of every shade. We moved to Harlem so she could see tykes like herself on the playground. As she's grown, she's 11 now, I always thought I was succeeding. But there was that bright, bracing autumn day 2 years ago when she and I went on a hike in the Hudson Valley. Wet leaves plastered the ground, a breeze chilled our ears, and my daughter pushed her mocha-skinned bitty twin doll in a stroller, straggling several yards behind me as I ascended the trail. And then I rounded a bend and saw a tall black man walking toward me. I froze. The back of my neck tensed. Adrenaline shot through my limbs. I registered that he was moving quickly. Separated from my daughter, my instinct was to protect her, to call out to her. But what would I call? Careful, here comes someone else enjoying the scent of pine needles. By the time my girl and the oncoming hiker reached me simultaneously, my panic had subsided. He smiled at us as he passed, using both hands to wave hello as if he were in a parade. Embarrassed, I greeted him with a nod. During my childhood, my Armenian parents cursed the Ottomans of the Turkish Empire that murdered all 8 of my great-grandparents because of their ethnicity. Yet I was forbidden to play inside the home of our African-American neighbors. My folks saw no link between their intolerance and the Turks' ethnic cleansing. Now, ambling with my daughter, I was overcome with shame. I hated that seeing a dark-skinned man had frightened me so easily, especially since my own child had a similar complexion. I felt the same split-second impulse as the men who shot Alton Sterling and Tamir Rice, one similar to gay panic, the urge to harm a queer person like me after perceiving a threat. And then I remembered. When the backpacker said hello, he'd raised his palms on either side of his head, as if to show he was unarmed. It looked like surrender to me, his progressive gay urbanite aggressor. When we adopted our daughter, I worried I wasn't prepared for the challenges of raising a child of color. Still, we took comfort in the fact that we were enlightened, that we knew better, that we were better. Hell, I'd even studied racial identity in college. But none of that had inoculated me against racist hair trigger fear. My daughter and I paused to catch our breath under a canopy of maple leaves. I reached into my knapsack and handed her a bag of dried fruit and nuts. She put a cranberry to the lips of her doll, then munched on it herself. Breathing in the mountain air, I recalled a saying that likened racism to smog. Although sometimes hard to see, it's everywhere. It's my job to both recognize its presence and fight against it, day by day, step by step. Our next article by Kimberly Zapata is titled, Jenna Bush Hager Proposed to Her Husband, Henry Hager, 5 years before they got engaged. It's been 13 years since Jenna Bush Hager married the love of her life, Henry Hager, but if it was up to her, the pair would have been married much sooner. On an episode of Today with Hoda and Jenna, Bush Hager revealed she proposed to Henry 5 years before he proposed to her. I asked Henry to marry me, Bush Hager said during a segment on being the chooser in your life, to which Hoda Kotb responded with shock. What? You did? How did I not know that? No, Bush Hager laughed. But Henry turned down Jenna's proposal for a very good and very sweet reason. After 3 months of dating, I might have had a Christmas cocktail, and we were dancing, and I said, this is it, I know it. Let's just get married. What are we waiting for? But he smiled and was like, I'm crazy about you, but you're young. Henry proposed to Jenna several years later in 2007, and the pair wed in 2008. That said, here's everything we know about their relationship and the man who turned the president's daughter down. Jenna Bush and Henry Hager met through mutual friends. According to the Today host, Bush, Hager, and Henry met during her father's 2004 re-election campaign, when a mutual friend invited him to Bush Hager's house to watch a football game. Henry and I had mutual friends who kind of set us up, Bush Hager said. He worked for my dad, and he had a girlfriend, but a friend of mine from college was his intern at work, and we were going to watch the Texas game, and she invited him. He came, and he was cute, Bush Hager said. Speaking of her father, Bush Hager and Henry Hager both come from political families. While everyone knows Jenna Bush Hager's father, Jenna is one of Laura Bush and President George W. Bush's two children, her husband also has political roots. Henry's father is John H. Hager, the former Lieutenant Governor of Virginia and the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education's Office of Special Education and Rehabilitation Services. Henry Hager also worked for President Bush. After graduating from the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, Henry joined the 43rd president re-election campaign. On election day, they were friends, a source told People in 2008, but by the inaugural, they were an item. However, in spite of their numerous connections, Bush Hager thought their age difference may be a problem. In fact, during a 2019 Today Show segment, Bush Hager, now 38, admitted that when she first met Henry, 41, she thought he was old. My friend was like, can we bring Henry? And I'm like, how old is he? He felt too old. He was only 28. But the pair quickly became a couple, and Henry Hager asked President Bush permission to wed his daughter in 2007. According to Good Housekeeping, the former president responded immediately and enthusiastically. So the guy comes to see me and he says, I want to marry your daughter, President George W. Bush recalled. I said, done deal. As for how the proposal went down, Henry took Jenna on vacation and, according to The Knot, popped the question while hiking Cadillac Mountain in Acadia National Park. Bush Hager and Henry got married in 2008. The couple wed at the family's 1,600-acre ranch near Crawford, Texas, and President Bush walked Jenna down the aisle. "We're mighty blessed," President Bush told CNN. "The wedding was spectacular. It was all we could have hoped for." After the wedding, the president said at a press conference, "Our little girl Jenna married a really good guy." Today, Henry Hager is a prominent businessman. Henry Hager is the managing director at Waterous Energy Fund and a member of the board of directors for the George W. Bush Presidential Center. Jenna and Henry have three children together. The couple welcomed their first child, Margaret Laura Myla Hager, in 2013. 2 years later, Bush Hager gave birth to their second child, Poppy Louise Hager. And in August of 2019, the pair had their third child and first son, Henry Harold Hal Hager. As for their romance, Bush Hager believes their love has never been stronger. During a Valentine's Day segment on Today, Bush Hager said their love is solid. "Your love is like the post-it note with stick figure drawings of ships passing you, left for me on the bathroom mirror when I returned home late. I'd been flying most of the day and I was dehydrated and thirsty for home, for you," she said. "Your love is like that note. It is simple and solid and thoughtful." Our next article by Joyce Maynard is titled "Saying Goodbye to This Is Us." "I sometimes speak of This Is Us, the beloved television series, as my guilty pleasure. The truth is, I see no reason to feel guilty about loving this show, for all its occasional sentimentality and the tendency of its characters to hold forth now and then with big speeches about the meaning of life. For 6 seasons, this story, more than any other on television, has spoken to my experiences over the past 4 decades as a woman and as a mother." The actress who plays the central character, Mandy Moore, tweeted shortly before the airing of the second-to-last episode that after they watched it, people were probably going to have to stay home from work the next day. Maybe this was a slight exaggeration, but she wasn't so far off. All across America, as the credits for that one rolled, viewers wept. I know I did. For those who haven't heard, This Is Us follows the story of a seemingly ordinary couple, Jack and Rebecca Pearson, living in Pittsburgh. One night in the summer of 1980, Rebecca gives birth to triplets. One of the babies dies. But on the very same night, someone leaves another newborn baby, who's black, on the steps of the hospital. Rebecca and Jack bring him home to be part of their family. And over the 6 seasons of the series that follow, some of us, me for one and a few million others, have followed those triplets and their parents and a whole constellation of other characters who came into their lives over the years. In season 2, Jack dies of smoke inhalation when their house burns down. A few years later, Rebecca marries Jack's best friend, Miguel. One of the sons becomes a TV star. One becomes a civic leader and eventually a U.S. senator. The daughter is a music teacher for blind children. We follow marriages and divorces, illness and loss, eating disorders, PTSD, issues involving adoption, race, and substance abuse, and a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, which brought us to that second-to-last chapter in which Rebecca, in the final stages of the disease, lies on a bed in the house one of her sons had built for her as the family gathers to say goodbye. There's a reason why This Is Us speaks to me. The siblings in the show are roughly the age of my own 3 children. As their story gets underway, their mother, Rebecca, is roughly the age I was when my first child, my daughter Audrey, was born. Nearly every stage I have watched this family go through has been one that I've lived through too. Like the Pearson's daughter, Kate, Audrey works with kids facing challenges. I even have a son who, like one of the 3 adult children on the show, is a successful television actor. Years ago, in fact, back when they were casting This Is Us, my son Wilson auditioned for the role of Kevin Pearson. Even now, when I watch the show, I imagine how it would be if it were Will up on the screen. Nearly every week for as long as I've been watching, moments in the life of the fictional television family have resonated with real-life memories. Being so exhausted that I'd fall asleep in the middle of reading my children a chapter of Charlotte's Web, dressing up for a rare dinner out my husband and I couldn't afford, getting a haircut inspired by Princess Diana. Like Rebecca, I once sat at the edge of a pool during swim lessons, holding the one who was scared, cheering on the one who wasn't. Years later, I saw my children head out into the world on their own, one by one, wishing I could protect them and knowing I couldn't. In so many ways, the story of the Pearson family was my story, too. Stark differences between our two families were equally obvious, sometimes painfully so. Though Jack and Rebecca experienced disagreements and occasional tension over the years, moments we watched in flashbacks, their marriage never appeared less than solid and deeply loving. My own marriage ended with no shortage of acrimony and a vast measure of grief when our children were all under age 12. One other part of the story followed over 6 years of watching This Is Us hit home. The Pearsons adopted a newborn infant whose birth parents were Black. As a single parent in my mid-50s, I adopted 2 older Black children orphaned by AIDS. The Pearsons' adopted son, Randall, though he struggles for a time over reconciling his place as a Black child in a white family, displays as deep a connection to his parents, his mother most of all. My own adoption failed. For reasons I do not speak about to protect the privacy of the 2 children who briefly knew me as their mother, this is not a story I am free to tell. Though I made the choice I believed was the best for my adopted daughters, not a day has gone by over the past 11 years when I did not think of them. I'm no Rebecca Pearson. Nobody knows better than I all the ways I have fallen short over the years. Picture me just a few days ago then, sitting in front of my laptop, which is where I follow the series, watching the episode in which Rebecca's 3 adult children gather at their mother's bedside as they say goodbye. Mandy Moore is made up to look like a woman around my age. One by one, in her final moments on Earth, each of the children tells their mother what she meant to them, which is just about everything. The scene led me to imagine my own death, taking place sometime in the next 5, 10, 15, 20, or 30 years, and how my own 3 children will handle it. For starters, as much as I believe my sons love me, I don't anticipate that either one of them will build me a house to live out my final years. Where the fictional Pearson family gathers together every single Thanksgiving to honor all sorts of beautiful lifelong family traditions, I haven't pulled off an all-family Thanksgiving since sometime in the 90s. There's this trap I fall into sometimes, most of us do, I think, of comparing myself to others around me who appear to have figured out how to make their way through life better than I have. Sometimes I go farther and compare not just myself, but our family to those of people around me, concluding that as much as we love each other, the idyllic moments I see in other people's Facebook posts and holiday letters to friends suggest they've done a better job than I did at pulling off that most elusive goal, raising a happy family. My children have scattered, 2 on one coast, 1 on the other. I see them as much as I can, but many months may go by between visits. My grandchildren know me mostly from FaceTime. This makes me sad. My children's father and I, though we greet each other in a friendly way when we meet, as we did not in the earlier years following our divorce, have not achieved some life-altering reconciliation. It is a source of incalculable joy that the younger of my adopted daughters is back in my life now, but not every story I've lived or those of most women I know has had a satisfying resolution. On the second-to-last episode of This Is Us, a dream Rebecca, walking through a series of train cars in her imagination as she lies on her deathbed, reflects on the many characters we've met over the years of watching the series. Rebecca is unfailingly beautiful and kind, loving, understanding, wise. In all the episodes I watched over the years, she never once picks up a milk carton, as I did one time when my kids were young, and upends it over her head. She never throws an egg she was about to put into the pancake batter across the kitchen at one of her sons when he talks back to her. She never tears the family's house apart in search of a lost Barbie shoe. I published a novel recently called Count the Ways that explored territory uncannily similar to that in This Is Us, spanning more than 4 decades in the life of a family with 3 children. In that novel, a work of fiction inspired by personal experience, in which the fictional mother, bearing a certain resemblance to myself, occasionally visits a place I call Crazy Land, the mother screws up regularly in ways Rebecca Pearson never did. As many heartbreaking events has transpired over those 6 seasons, at its core, This Is Us is a story of a happy family. The stability of the children's early years resonates through their lives. As much as the lives of 3 children in the show were shaped by the deep love and connection of their parents' marriage, The lives of my own three well-loved children were affected by the rupture that took place in their fathers and mine. My children's father didn't die, and it would be easy to conclude that a parent's death is the greater trauma for a child than divorce. But divorce incurs a different kind of injury, also deep, also enduring. Mothers have a way of taking on responsibility for every single hard thing that happens in their children's lives and blaming themselves. I've carried with me always regret that of all the things I wanted to give to my children and all the things I did to protect them when they were young, in this one crucial way I failed them. I couldn't give them the experience of growing up with two happy, loving parents raising them together side by side. I would have given almost anything to have been able to do that, same as I would have given a lot to have been the mother my adopted daughters needed. Last week, sitting with my glass of wine, widowed as Rebecca was, following a good and loving second marriage, I tuned into that second-to-last episode and engaged once again in my habit of comparing my story to that of beautiful, serene, endlessly patient Rebecca Pearson, as portrayed by Mandy Moore. No big surprise, I fell short. Most of us would. As I watched, the three television siblings, all in their 40s now, like my oldest two, had nothing but great things to say to Rebecca at her bedside about the amazing job she'd done as their mother. The speeches my own children would make as I lay dying in some imagined version of my own final chapter might be more complicated. The same could be said of what my bedside farewells to my own parents would have been had they taken place. If we were honest, there would have been some things to say to my parents about sorrow, loss, disappointment, and a wish that we could do some things over. But here's where I stand today. As a 68-year-old mother of three, still walking this earth, fully or mostly in possession of all my faculties, though my right knee isn't what it used to be. Maybe some of what I say about this will speak to some other imperfect mother reading this, who felt the same sense of inadequacy watching This Is Us over these past few episodes as the Pearson children prepared for the loss of their mother. I'm probably not the only one who registered the thought, oh God, what would my children say at such a moment about me? We do the best we can. We all make large and sometimes damaging mistakes. At the end of the day, it's up to the next generation to decide what to do about those. Make our peace and move on, or allow ourselves to become embittered or crushed by them. The consensus of the adult Pearson siblings on This Is Us appeared to be that Rebecca Pearson was probably the best mother in the history of the world. Her children will honor her memory forever, same as they do that of their father. As for my children, I accept that the accolades at the time of my death may fall a little short of those delivered on the show. It's enough that we love each other and forgive each other our failings and make our own good lives. As a daughter of two parents I deeply loved, both long dead, she made costly mistakes for which I forgave them long ago. Here's what I would like to receive from my own children whenever the day comes that they bid me farewell. Love and forgiveness. Simple as that. Years ago, my daughter Audrey told me about four short sentences called the Ho'oponopono prayer, which originated in Hawaii. Speak these four sentences out loud to someone you care about, possibly a person with whom you've had issues, and things will change for the better, she said. You can say them in any order with the same result, she told me. My daughter wasn't wrong. The sentences of the prayer go like this. I love you. I'm sorry. Thank you. Please forgive me. More than once over the years, when I have spoken those phrases out loud to somebody, something shifts. I don't need to be some icon of perfect motherhood in my children's eyes. I'll take human. More valuable even than the lessons our children may learn from our accomplishments and successes are those that they take from our failures and shortcomings, particularly when we admit to them. That's where compassion comes from. That's how they may learn, perhaps, how to do better themselves. A television series ends eventually. A family goes on. Our next article by Erin O'Brien is titled Surrogates, The Fear, Grit, and Love of Two Ukrainian Mothers. In the early hours of the 21st day after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Tasia Zaima gripped the edges of her hospital bed and leave, her pink gel nails digging into her palms. She is blonde and blue-eyed, and her dark, tattooed eyebrows were knit together in concentration and pain. with a black t-shirt and colorful blankets bunched around her, black plastic covering the windows behind her to hide the hospital's lights, she heaved her way through her final moments of labor. Five nurses and a doctor encouraged her, told her to breathe, to keep pushing another person's child into this world. More than 300 miles away in Kyiv, the capital of her country, Russian troops were attacking harder and more ruthlessly each day. They hit a civilian apartment block while Tasia was in labor, killing five residents. In the southern port city of Mariupol, hundreds of thousands of civilians were trapped under siege by Russian forces, with limited food and water. Corpses, including those of children and babies, lay in the street and on the cold floor of a makeshift morgue in a hospital basement there. The city of Kharkiv was heavily damaged by the Russian army, and the city of Kherson occupied. As Tasia pushed mightily, willing new life into the world, the lives of hundreds of children had already been lost. Tasia is a surrogate mother, one of an estimated 1,000 Ukrainian surrogates who were pregnant when Russia instigated the war. In the days leading up to her birth, Tasia had thought often of the baby's biological parents, whose sperm and egg made the fetus inside of her. They lived in the United States, a place she'd never seen. She thought of Amelia, her own daughter, 8 years old now, tall and with her father's dark eyes. Tasia and Artem, her partner, had decided he would stay in their village of Pershepin in Dnipropetrovsk, the region in central Ukraine where they live, with Amelia, while Tasia traveled to Kyiv to birth the child she was being paid to carry. All her plans, to return to Pershepin to fix up her family's small home, to one day use the money from the surrogacy to move to Europe with Artem and Amelia, were made before the war. And yet now, all she could hope was that the war wouldn't creep so close to Dnipropetrovsk that Amelia would see it. It was ironic, she thought. Couples from all over the world have for years hired surrogate mothers in Ukraine because it's one of the few countries that allows foreigners to do so. And yet now, with Russian troops closing in on the capital and many parts of the country under attack, Ukraine felt like the last place on earth in which anyone would want to have a child. When would this baby be able to meet his parents? The doctor's voice, firm and growing louder, implored her to keep pushing. The nurses stood, their eyes intent over their face masks, ready. Tasia pushed, drawing three breaths, every ounce of strength in her body focused on that baby boy. Her nails dug into her palms until she thought they might bleed. A few nights before Russia invaded Ukraine, Dr. Helena Strelko, the co-founder and lead reproduction specialist of the IVMed Family Clinic, where Tasia carried out her surrogacy, attended a classical music concert in Kyiv. One of her son's friend's parents was in the orchestra, and after the performance, they gathered outside. Strelko had sent her 16-year-old son to England to live with her brother a few days prior, while her older son stayed in the western part of the country. He is a fighting age. Her friends chided her. There will never be a war, they said. They told her she was paranoid. In the earliest hours of the following morning, Strelko heard an explosion. She called IVMed's director of embryology laboratory, biologist Viral Aiden, who was already awake and on its way to the clinic. One intended family described him as an embryologist like no other, who spent 6 hours poring over their biological samples to find a single viable sperm cell. He's also the kind of person who always has a backup plan. He couldn't let anything happen to the 36,400 embryos stored in cryogenic containers in the clinic, and he knew what to do with them. Strelko lived near the sites of explosions and was stuck in the standstill traffic of thousands trying to flee the city. At the clinic, Aiden stared in the morning light at the rows of nitrogen-filled cryogenic containers holding tens of thousands of embryos from all over the world. Each container weighs over 60 kilograms, nearly impossible for one person to lift. Plus, the clinic was next to a military building, and movement on the street was already being tightly monitored. Removing the tanks would be risky. They could be wrongly shot at by Ukrainian security forces, or the tanks could be damaged. But Aiden thought the Russians wouldn't give up until they'd taken the capital. For weeks, he had been preparing to escape, a go bag ready by his front door. Another embryologist arrived just before 8 a.m., and the two biologists, using strength neither knew they possessed, carried four cryogenic jars to his Volvo SUV, each containing up to 1,300 embryos. By the time Strelko arrived at 10 a.m., Aiden was already on his way to the Polish border. Tasia, who was 29, spoke with Artem on the phone nearly every day. She had grown up in Pershepin, the same village where they were raising Amelia, more than 600 miles from Lviv. Tasia's childhood home was surrounded by fields, gardens, and small farms filled with cows, chickens, and pigs. She liked that she and Artem were raising Amelia in the same village, but Tasia dreamed of moving to the European Union. For the time being, their home was safe, Artem told her on their calls. The bombing had not reached Dnipropetrovsk. Amelia was continuing remote learning, and sometimes she would get on the phone with Tasia for help with math homework. Her whole life, Tasia had made plans. We all make plans. The house we're going to buy, the country we're going to move to, the person we're going to marry, the baby we're going to have, or not. Surrogacy is a complicated plan, one that entangles the lives of three people absent other options, but it is a plan nonetheless. Tasia was to be paid 14,000 euros, or around $14,770 for carrying the baby, nearly four times the average per capita income in Ukraine. Once the decision is made, the clinic consulted, and the pregnancy begins, there is, barring tragedy, an expected outcome. A baby, a payment, a new life for both the parents and the surrogate mother. Plans change, of course, and we as humans adapt. Pregnancies end or babies get sick, but few plan for a nuclear superpower to invade its neighbor in the midst of a pregnancy involving people on opposite sides of the world. How, as a surrogate mother, do you navigate the birth of another family's baby amid war? How do you adapt to that? Tasia was raised by her grandmother and never had a deep connection with her mother. Maybe because of that, she lives for her own daughter. Whenever she talks about Amelia, Tasia pulls up pictures on her phone. Amelia in the snow. Amelia smiling in a sundress. Amelia, Artem, and Tasia at a skating rink. Their little family is her whole world, and in her glances, at her phone after she hangs up a video call or is sadly down at her hands when talking about her, she betrays the pain of being separated from them. Leaving Amelia to come to Kyiv for her third trimester, a contractual obligation of surrogacy, war or not, was one of the hardest things she has ever done. The thing is, she became a surrogate for them, for Amelia and Artem, and herself. Tasia decided to carry other people's children not only to help other people create families, but also to build a better life for her own. Just as she had left Pershepin when Amelia was three to work in a factory in Poland to earn money for her family, so too would she be away from them for the last 3 months of her surrogate pregnancy to earn enough money to better their lives. But as she sat in the sterile hospital room nearly 1,000 miles from her daughter, she knew her plans had been catastrophically disrupted. In Ukraine, surrogacy is an industry. Like other industries, it is governed by rules and regulations. Surrogacy was legalized in Ukraine in 2002, codified in the country's legal family code. Unlike in most of the world, the biological parents of an embryo implanted in a surrogate are recognized from transfer or implantation as parents, if and only if they are heterosexually married. Gay and unmarried parents are banned from surrogacy in Ukraine. The industry was further regulated by Order 787 issued by the Ministry of Health in September 2013. This outlined not only further qualifications, such as a documented failure to get pregnant and the necessity of a heterosexual marriage license required to employ a surrogate, but also regulated and licensed the clinics that were allowed to carry out surrogacy procedures. Before this, the system for carrying out a surrogacy had been vague, almost ad hoc. Now there was a framework for establishing a regulated, potentially profitable private surrogacy clinic. The private surrogacy industry in Ukraine boomed. Alina Strelko founded IVMed in Kyiv the year Order 787 was passed. In its first year of operation, IVMed made just a few dozen embryo transfers. In 2020, that number was up to 1,415. In 2021, they implanted 1,897 embryos in surrogate mothers, a record for the clinic. Even today, when looking at the PowerPoints she presented to her staffers on February 23, 2022, she gets emotional. Normally, intended parents, parents who want to have a child via a surrogate, reach out to the agency via social media or Google. Order 787 stipulated that those eligible to work with a surrogacy clinic in Ukraine must have tried to have children by all other means or must be physically unable to. These are people who have lost hope. For many, this is their last chance, Struckel says. When an egg is fertilized, the clinic places it in a cryogenic storage container. From there, once a suitable surrogate is found, who legally and per IV meds practice is under 36, has at least one child already, and does not have substance abuse disorders, the clinic transfers the embryo into the woman's uterus using a catheter-like tube. If the first transfer does not take, they try again after the surrogate mother's next menstrual cycle. Tasia became pregnant shortly after her first transfer. Once they're pregnant, women working with IV Med follow the Ministry of Health instructions and get ultrasounds every month in most cases. They receive a monthly stipend for living expenses, 350 euros, about 369 US dollars, in Tasia's case, sent by the intended parents. If all goes well and the babies are healthy, mothers remain in their own homes until near the beginning of their third trimester. At that point, they move into apartments rented by the clinic in Kyiv, where they wait to give birth. Tasia moved into her apartment in early December 2021. The war began on February 24th. The last time she saw her family was when they visited her around New Year's Eve. Intended parents generally fly to Kyiv shortly before the birth and are often in the room when their babies are born. Then, because they are there and because Ukrainian law recognizes intended parents, they sign the baby's birth certificate. The surrogate mother relinquishes legal rights to the child, the parents take the baby home, and the surrogate returns to her own family. It took Aiden more than 27 hours to drive the 340 miles to leave, just a few hours from the Polish border. He didn't sleep. He then waited over 30 hours at the border near Przemyśl, moving just 3/4 of a mile. As he and another biologist sat in his car, the nitrogen keeping the embryos alive was depleting. They decided to try another checkpoint where they waited for another 22 hours. By the time they arrived at a Slovakian border checkpoint and were able to pass using a medical exemption, they had been traveling with little food or sleep for nearly 3 days. Between Aiden's car and the car of another embryologist, 8 of the clinic's 25 barrels made it across the border on this trip. But this was only one of multiple trips. In the end, all 36,400 embryos from the clinic were saved. For the next 2 weeks, Aiden, Strelko, and their team transported tens of thousands of embryos from Kyiv to Lviv, then from Lviv to Bratislava. Drives that normally would have taken half a day took multiple days and nights. Clinic staff and partners from cryogenic companies drove the embryos through the night through a countrywide curfew on roads that had been stripped of lights and street signs, an attempt to thwart Russian troop advancement. At one point, she thinks due to the stress of the war and the embryo evacuation, Strelko partially lost her eyesight. The last batch of embryos was hurried out of the country from Lviv to Bratislava in the darkest hours of the night of March 13th, less than 3 weeks into the war. As Strelko and Aiden scrambled to evacuate embryos from the country, Tasia sat alone in her prefab clinic-paid apartment in northwest Kyiv. She didn't hear sirens before the first missiles hit. She thought the explosions might be a fluke or her imagination and went back to sleep. But when she woke up again, she had dozens of messages from friends and family checking if she was all right. She called Artem and Amelia. Tasia's apartment was on the southwestern outskirts of the city. Explosions of at least 2 surface-to-air missiles were reported over the city, and Ukraine's foreign minister said it was the largest attack on the city since Nazis attacked it in 1941. Tasia called the clinic, and they told her to stay where she was. Instead, Tasia walked downstairs to the building's car park, where people were sheltering. It was cold and damp and full of crying children and maskless adults. Shivering and nearly 40 weeks pregnant, she decided she was safer in her apartment. She trudged the 4 flights back upstairs, and there she stayed for a week without leaving. Tasia had some of her things in the apartment, but it wasn't her home. She kept busy on her phone and with her knitting. She looked out the window a lot, and the people on the ground below looked like ants. When the sirens went off or when there was a sound of an explosion, they would scatter. She knit a fluffy green blanket for the unborn child and hoped to give it to his parents after his birth. The violence edged ever closer to where she sat. On February 28, the Adonis Maternity Hospital, just 20 miles from Tasia's apartment, was hit by a missile. The women there, some pregnant, some with newborns, spent days sheltering in the damaged building and then escaped to a nearby kindergarten with barely any food or water for themselves or the babies. Tasia realized she wanted to go home to her little house in Pershepin, to her daughter and her husband and her life and her little kitchen where she made thin pancakes filled with jam. The realization made her weep. For years, all she'd wanted was to leave Ukraine and go to the European Union for better opportunities for Amelia. And yet now, when the countries she dreamed of living in were taking in Ukrainians visa-free, she would have given anything just to return to their small, beautiful life. On March 1st, a Viber message from the clinic popped up onto Sia's phone. Strelko's husband, Sergei Moskalenko, would drive a group of surrogates from Kyiv, which was growing increasingly dangerous, to the relative safety of Lviv in the west. The conflict was edging closer to the capital. A 65-kilometer-long Russian convoy was amassing on the outskirts of Kyiv, and a television tower had been struck in the center of the city. Attacks on civilian targets were increasing. Tasia hastily packed a backpack, leaving most of her things behind. She was told there would be 7 women in the car and little room for luggage. She called her family, told them she was leaving Kyiv, and slept one last night alone. The apartment she had been living in was near Kyiv's Sikorsky International Airport and government facilities, and the road leading to it had been blocked for days. Tasia, who was now just a week before her due date, walked down the 4 flights of stairs and over a mile to the outer edge of her neighborhood. There, she met Sergei and another surrogate, Ulyana Zrahintseva, 25, pregnant with twins from surrogate parents. Tasia settled into the front seat next to Sergei. Ulyana and her 2.5-year-old daughter Anastasia sat in the back. None of the other mothers showed up. They left Kyiv at 10 a.m. and inched through hordes of cars snaking their way out of the city, thousands of people desperate to flee the war biting at their city's edges. They saw evidence of the war everywhere. Tasia hadn't been able to see from the window of her apartment. Destroyed buildings, missile-hit apartment blocks, a fuel depot on fire. Tasia and Ulyana tried to distract Anastasia from seeing the otherworldly destruction. It took 4 hours to get out of the city. Sergei decided to drive south, avoiding the Kyiv-Zhytomyr Highway, which at the time was a site of intense fighting. The route brought them through small towns and extended a normally 6-hour drive to 2 days. The scariest part was when it got dark. They drove the unmarked, unlit country roads for hours under a sliver of a new moon, until suddenly a Ukrainian checkpoint would appear, almost floating in the darkness. A hut, a barricade, a torch, a man with a gun. They stayed quiet while the local forces checked their car at one checkpoint after another. Even after the 10 p.m. curfew, they kept on steady. Anastasia was restless, screaming or babbling and squirming in the back seat. Near midnight, they arrived at Medzibze, a traditionally Jewish enclave where a family friend of Sergei's parents had an apartment. The next morning, after breakfast, they kept driving. They arrived in Lviv at 3 p.m. on March 3rd. Sergei showed Tasia, Ulyana, and Anastasia to a small apartment they'd found through a friend of Strelko's in Lviv. On the news, they got through the messaging and social media app Telegram. They read that there were hundreds of thousands of other displaced Ukrainians in the city, too, people like them arriving from all across the country, desperate to escape the Russian assault. They were lucky to find a place to sleep. Soon, in the apartment with its small sunlit kitchen, they became a temporary family and built a makeshift life, 2 pregnant women brought together by the children of others. They made pancakes with jam and sugar. Tasia's due date came and passed in Lviv. She felt the baby moving up her abdomen, not down, the way it should. On March 12th, as she sat in the kitchen waiting and drinking tea and chatting with Ulyana, the baby's hands and feet were visible through her pink sweater, kicking and pushing, up, up, up. Tasia laughed. "He knows what's going on," she said. Ulyana didn't have a strong relationship with her mother or her father. She was raised by a grandmother who could be spiteful. She was happy now in the love Tasia showed her in Anastasia. Tasia was only 4 years older than her, but Ulyana soon came to see her as the mother she never had. To see it cared for Anastasia and even scolded her sometimes while Ilyana cooked for them both. Chickens, stews, and sometimes the women ordered desserts. In the morning, they woke up and stripped their couch beds, then set about the day together. Walking hand in hand with Anastasia, one pregnant woman on each side, they walked to the market, to the pharmacy, to the small playground near the apartment complex. One morning, the three of them were standing in line at the pharmacy when a message on Viber, a messaging app that allows simultaneous translation, lit up to Sia's phone. It was from her baby's intended parents. They would not be able to pick up the baby at birth after all, it read. They didn't have the proper visas, and embassies in Ukraine were closed. They would do their best to get their child as soon as possible, but they asked Tasia to stay with the baby until they could. A change of plans. She read the message again in disbelief, and then, standing amid the vitamins and hair conditioner and rows of toothbrushes, she began to cry. Hot tears she had been holding back for weeks. Ilyana enveloped her as Anastasia puttered loudly around the store with a child-sized shopping cart. Tasia had never wanted anything in her life as badly as she wanted Amelia at that moment, and never before had it been so uncertain when she would see her daughter next. I've run out of time to continue this article today, so I'll end here and I will finish this article on the July 22nd podcast of Oprah, which will air next week. Tasia had never wanted anything in her life as badly as she wanted Amelia at that moment, and never before had it been so uncertain when she would see her daughter next. I've run out of time to continue this article today, so I'll end here and I will finish this article on the July 22nd podcast of Oprah, which will air next week. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.